We're going to hear now about another high-tech giant, Google. You can think of Google and its search engine as a well-traveled interstate. It's how people get where they want to go on the internet. So you Google tomatoes, mozzarella, and basil, for example, and you'll get instructions for a caprese salad. It's your way onto the web. And like a real highway, a whole industry has grown up around the popular search engine, kind of like fast food joints and motels sprout up along the highway. We're going to take a look at the economy that's built up around this reliance on Google in two parts this week. In the first, NPR's Zoe Chase explains how companies use the way you search to make money.
Because you search for this.
How do I brush my teeth?
You get this.
How to brush your teeth. There's two pieces of advice you can never go wrong by following.
Ready? Here comes the big reveal.
Floss and brush at least twice a day to keep your pearly whites bright and healthy.
There are so many people asking Google questions that a slew of companies have shot up over the past couple years to provide you with answers. One of them is Howcast.com, headquartered in an airy loft in downtown Manhattan. They commission how-to videos. The company is prospering but has a real startup feel. The office is clean and crisp and a little hip, like you're walking around the Apple store. So what are we looking at?
These are spreadsheets that show a little bit of the process of going from queries, search queries, to titles.
Tom Bender is a supervising producer at Howcast. He's pulled up a list of the things you search for about dance.
How to dance, Dougie dance, hip-hop dance, wedding dance, dance moves, Cupid shuffle.
How much can Howcast make off the question, how to dance the Cupid Shuffle? To decide whether to commission a video, Bender gives it a score. He won't reveal all the ingredients, it's a secret sauce. But here are the main factors.
So for example, eye makeup. So that query receives about 200,000 searches per month on YouTube.
That's one. How many times the topic eye makeup is searched on YouTube? 200,000. He looks at how many results come up for this search. It's not that much by comparison, so he feels his video can compete here. And the third factor, and this is very important.
And then we also look at things like cost per click associated with that query.
The cost per click. That's how much advertisers are willing to spend to put an ad next to this particular topic if your video shows up near the top of the YouTube results. This is how you succeed in this field. It's with this formula. If you have a formula that allows you to be at the top of a Google search, then you can make a killing. The cost per click is the engine that drives sites like Howcast to make entire video series on a topic like
understanding the types of harmonicas, how to play a chromatic harmonica, how to play a diatonic harmonica, how to play a blues harmonica, how to play a harmonica solo.
Four blow, five blow, five draw, six blow, five blow.
Right above our heads is the Howcast studio, where we find harmonica player Marcus Melius. He's seated on a stool in a sweaty suit and bowler cap, creating answers to these profitable questions.
How many do you have left to do?
Nine.
Really?
Yeah.
You could think of him as a well-dressed factory worker. The videographer has a list next to him of more than 20 individual titles for videos that he checks off as Milius gets up to stretch his legs. There's no ambiguity.
Pretty much they gave me the list, and I'm just creating content based upon those questions.
There's an entire industry that's sprung up around the idea of search engine optimization, of understanding how Google thinks, of how Bing thinks, and reverse engineer how the search engines do their searches.
Daniel Roth is an editor with Fortune magazine. He says how-to sites are very desirable to advertisers for one simple reason. The content doesn't have an expiration date. It stays fresh.
And advertisers don't necessarily want to be up against coverage of Japan or coverage of the recession. If you sell carpet cleaner, and the how-to site is how to stop your dog from peeing on the rug, then that is a perfect article you want to be next to.
Remember that search for eye makeup that Howcast ended up making an entire series about? An article on how to put on eye makeup is just as pertinent in 6 months as it is right now. So if the company creating the content really gets their formula right, their article on eye makeup should stay at the top of your search results for a long time. That's great for advertisers. In fact, Roth says there's so much money to be made attracting advertisers to evergreen content that some companies have followed the formula to its logical conclusion, putting out sites that have more ads than they have content. His term for sites like this, content farms.
Content farms pay people almost no money to turn out very mediocre content that can serve up very cheap ads. It's pure Google arbitrage.
Content farms have swamped your search results, like algae taking over a pond. And Google's not too happy about it. We'll spend some time on the content farm tomorrow on Morning Edition. Zoe Chace, NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Apple's quarterly results once again beat Wall Street expectations. The company nearly doubled its net income. Blockbuster iPhone and Mac sales fueled the growth. The success comes despite some concerns about how the earthquake in Japan might affect Apple's supply chain. NPR's Laura Seidel reports.
Apple is now the world's most valuable technology company, and it looks like there's no stopping it. Apple had record iPhone sales, more than 18.5 million. The iPhone now makes up half of Apple's revenues. The company's COO, Tim Cook, said in a conference call the lion's share of growth happened in China.
And so we feel very, very good about where we are.
And they should. Sales in China quadrupled over last year. Revenue was up to nearly $5 billion. The Apple store in Shanghai is selling more than the one on Fifth Avenue in New York City. Things went well for Apple despite its deep connection to suppliers in Japan, where the effects of the earthquake and tsunami continue. Cook expressed sadness over the events there, but said Apple had worked closely with its suppliers.
Our preference from the beginning of this tragedy has been to remain with our long-term partners in Japan. And I have to say they have displayed an incredible resilience that I've personally never seen before.
Cook says sales of the iPhone were also helped by its availability on carriers other than AT&T, especially Verizon. Apple's MacBook Pro sales were also up nearly 30% over last year. Apple's iPad sales fell below expectations. The company admitted it couldn't make them fast enough. Although the situation in Japan remains precarious, analyst Tim Beharin of Creative Strategies believes Apple isn't likely to face many manufacturing obstacles.
They never rely on just a single supplier. They are bringing in components from partners in Taiwan, China, as well as Japan. And so they're pretty well insulated.
Apple is also benefiting from an overall market shift away from the desktop, says Carl Howe, an analyst with Yankee Group.
Now we're moving into a very mobile connected market, one in which we take our devices everywhere and we use them all the time.
Howe says about 1.5 billion people have a desktop computer, whereas about 5 billion and counting have a mobile device. Apple's great earnings came on the heels of happy news from Intel and IBM. Howe says Intel is making chips for many mobile devices, and IBM is making the servers.
So when you have a mobile device, you use it to get to some type of content, and those content providers typically run on big iron, the sort of stuff that IBM makes.
Howe isn't convinced that the tech sector will continue its role when the numbers come out from the big desktop companies, Dell and HP. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
Two computer researchers are making waves with their announcement that Apple's new iPhone quietly keeps track of every place you take it, even if you turn off the GPS function. NPR's Martin Kosty reports.
Alistair Allen says the iPhone 4 is constantly recording its location relative to nearby cell phone towers and Wi-Fi signals. He found the data when he was looking at the files created when you sync your phone with your computer.
I stumbled across a directory that's actually named Location D, and I thought, well, that looks interesting, which was full of latitudes and longitudes and timestamps.
In other words, all the information needed for a detailed map of everywhere the phone's owner has been. In fact, Allen's colleague, Pete Warden, has released a simple program that lets users create maps of all the data saved by their phone so far. Allen and Warden say the iPhone tracking was already a known piece of inside knowledge among hacker types, but they wanted to make sure everybody was aware of it. Warden says there's no evidence the location information is being sent to anybody else.
So don't panic, but we do want to know more about what's happening with this data.
Privacy experts say a person's location history could be seized for a lawsuit or criminal investigation, or maybe swiped by a computer virus. iPhone maker Apple has not responded to repeated requests for comment. Martin Costi, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. If you've ever used a smartphone to find, say, the nearest sushi restaurant, it should come as no surprise that the phone can track your location. Well, two researchers say the iPhone continues to keep track of you, even when you think you've turned off the location services. And NPR's Martin Costi says that no one quite knows why.
You can turn off the GPS function on your iPhone, but it can still figure out its location by looking at nearby cell phone towers and Wi-Fi signals. And now it turns out the iPhone is constantly recording that information and tucking it into a hidden file.
That's the thing that most upsets me.
Alistair Allen is a computer researcher who recently stumbled across the file. Looking at the file produced by his own iPhone, he was surprised by how detailed it was. For 9 months, his iPhone logged its location up to 1,000 times a day.
I love to look at this data. This data was a great data set to visualize. I just wouldn't want anyone else to have it.
Allen isn't the first to discover the iPhone tracking file. In fact, it's been something of a professional secret among forensic technologists. Those are the people who help police to get evidence off of phones and other devices. People like Alex Levinson.
I really don't see that as a problem. I see that as, you know, a bonus. We're making the life of law enforcement easier.
Levinson works for a company called Katana Forensics. He says he's surprised the iPhone tracking file is getting so much media attention.
I guess from my perspective, maybe I was a little blind to the public's perception of this. I mean, phone forensics have been doing this for a while.
And Levinson says iPhone users should rest easy. There's no evidence that the location data are being sent back to Apple, and police still need a court order to get it. But privacy advocates say that misses the larger point. The location file is a tempting target for other people, too. It could be subpoenaed in a lawsuit or in a messy divorce, or it could be stolen by a computer virus. Peter Eckersley at the Electronic Frontier Foundation says Apple failed in its duty to inform its customers what their iPhones are up to.
The problem is just not providing a clear indication to the user that this information is being recorded and a nice, easy way to get rid of it.
But Eckersley says Apple isn't alone in this. Tech companies are generally opaque about what kind of location data they collect. Amazon, for instance, doesn't disclose what, if any, location data it saves from all those Kindles out there. And Eckersley says even cell phone companies can be mysterious about what they do with the location data from their networks.
We're really only just starting to turn over this rock to see what's going on underneath. And I'm sure there will continue to be revealing stories about this kind of location tracking in the future.
Right now, the big question is, what is the iPhone tracking file for? It first appeared in a system update last summer, and some computer experts speculate that it may be the groundwork for some future location service. Jeff Fishback, a forensic technologist in California, says attitudes towards Apple might be very different right now if, instead of hiding the tracking file, the company had advertised it.
What's funny is I think you could just sell people devices and say, oh, and by the way, in case you ever thought you'd forget about what you were doing last week, our device has this new added feature, if you want to pay for it, that will journal your day for you.
That may have been the plan, but for now, Apple won't say. It hasn't responded to several requests for an interview, and yesterday, even Senator Al Franken weighed in, sending a letter to Steve Jobs asking for an explanation. So far, he hasn't heard back. Martin Costi, NPR News.
Tech privacy is a big issue in Michigan right now, where the Michigan State Police has begun using something called an extraction device. When attached to a cell phone, it can download a person's text messages, photos, video, contacts, you name it. The MSP insists the device is only being used with a search warrant or with the permission of the phone's owner. Still, the American Civil Liberties Union is crying foul. And for more on this, we're joined by Brian Cooley. He's an editor-at-large with the online tech magazine CNET. Brian, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, begin by telling us a little bit more about the device itself. It's pretty small, but it sounds like it's also pretty powerful.
This is a device that looks kind of like, honestly, like a handheld game console from maybe 10, 15 years ago. It's about two or three times the size of a cell phone. It's got a very unusual array of buttons and a screen on it, but it's definitely a portable device.
Who makes it and what does it do?
It's made by a company called Cellbrite, which apparently is based in Japan but has divisions all around the world from my research. And what you do is you connect a portable device to it, typically a cell phone or a smartphone. It can connect to, I think, almost 6,000 different portable devices that we carry. And some of those are also GPS units. So it doesn't just pull data from phones, though that is the majority of what it targets.
In what kinds of situations would the Michigan State Police actually use an extraction device? Are we talking about routine traffic stops or more serious situations where cracking a phone could provide key evidence?
Well, here's where the MSP is saying that they don't just somehow snoop your phone wirelessly while they're writing you a ticket. They physically have to cable it to this device. So it's not quite as surreptitious as sort of snooping across thin air, which, as far as I know, is not possible at this point. This device connects physically to your phone. So you would have to have handed your phone to an officer, or they would have had to have taken it from you. They, of course, are claiming that they're doing this with full consent of the user of the device or with a court order. But in the field, of course, things can vary.
Other police departments using this, or is MSP being used sort of as a test case?
They seem to be, at the very least, the most prominent force that's using this device. I did some research on training programs that are being conducted for this Cellbrite device. And I found, right off the bat, 8 different seminars around the country coming up in the next few months. There's one out here in the San Francisco Bay Area in July, for example. They don't hold seminars that, by the way, are apparently about $1,800 to attend for nobody to come to. And it's not a sales meeting because they would do those for free to get you to buy the device. This is high-dollar training for, apparently, agencies that already own them.
Was this created with law enforcement in mind, or was it sort of an offshoot of some other device that was used for transactions, commercial transactions or something else?
This technology had its roots in the cell phone stores. When you go to trade in your cell phone, you want to get a new one, they'll often offer, and most folks absolutely love this, to transfer all of your contacts, your photos, all your information from your old phone to your new one. Because that's really hard to do for the average user to bring their phone home and sync and cross-transfer data. So this technology really exists for the cell phone industry, but you can use it any number of ways. It could be used in local law enforcement. It can be used in the various black ops divisions of federal defense and the federal government. Anyone who has an interest, whether it's legitimate or not, in getting data off a phone is going to be interested in this device.
Brian Cooley, good to talk to you. Please come back again.
Thanks a lot.
That's Brian Cooley. He's an editor-at-large at the online tech magazine CNET.
This is NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Let's look again at those internet sites that serve up answers to all your pressing questions. Yesterday, we heard how popular and profitable how-to content has become on the web. Today, we'll examine the explosion of such sites. When you type, "How do I brush my teeth?" or "How do I fix the light in my 2000 Silverado?" there are hundreds, if not thousands, of results. And Google is not too happy about it, as NPR's Zoe Chase reports.
The reason there are so many answers to your questions online is simple. It's easy money. Popular answers to "How do I brush my teeth?" can stay at the top of your search results for a long time. That means a lot of eyeballs on the answer and the ads right next to them for, say, toothpaste, dental floss, or mint gum. Advertisers love to appear next to answers to your questions. The money is so easy, some content-providing sites contain more ads than they do answers. Fortune editor Daniel Roth calls them content farms.
Content farms pay people almost no money to turn out very mediocre content that can serve up very cheap ads. It's pure Google arbitrage.
Here's how you know a content farm when you see one. Google how to change a tire.
And there is a 6-point explanation of how to change a tire. And point 3 is something like, get out of the car. Try to find your jack. And you can tell that whoever was writing this was trying to finish it as quickly as possible in order to get the tiny amounts of money they're making for doing these stories.
I look at it like $8 is $8. If I'll give them $8 worth of work, the more I can cram in, the better on a payday.
Sasha Maggio writes for a few of the sites that some have called content farms. Here's how she structures her day.
So when you log in, it brings you to what they call my work desk.
At the work desk, there's a list of automatically generated topics based on how popular they are in search engines.
How to inflate tennis balls, history of the NBA championship ring, guide to dating mature women.
How to date a Japanese girl?
Yes. I mean, these are not ones that I pick up, though. I don't create these topics. I just go into the content pool and I find them. How to buy martial arts training mats, 5 Taekwondo tips.
Maggio is a military wife who works from home with a Pomeranian on her lap. After looking for work for months in Fairfax, Virginia, where her husband is stationed, she decided to go back to school to get a master's degree in psychology. She supports herself by freelance writing.
My best day, I wrote 10 in about 75 minutes. So you gotta figure, I made $80 in 75 minutes, which is decent. I mean, that's more than I made when I was working full time.
It's $15 an article for eHow, $8 an article for MadeMan.com, and $1 an article, plus revenue traffic for Examiner.com. To keep it straight, Maggio has a notebook open on her desk with a different colored pen assigned to each of her employers. Today she starts with eHow.
So I have sales closing tips, tips for a passive-aggressive boss, the effects of a tsunami on oil storage tanks. Some of these you have to look up. Some of them, they're not too bad, but all of them require a reference, so you got to do some kind of research.
Because eHow requires a reference, not all of Maggio's employers do, Google might consider it a higher quality site and rank it high in your search results. There's so much money to be made at ranking high in Google search results that we ought to just ask Google how it's done. Google?
We use a lot of different factors. In fact, we have more than 200 different signals that we use in our ranking.
Matt Cutts is an engineer in charge of the algorithm that Google uses to generate search results. And what Cutts and his team of engineers decided recently is they don't like the glut of sites that show up every time you search how to do something.
Does an article have spelling or stylistic or factual errors? You know, how well is it edited? Does the article have an excessive number of ads, maybe that might interfere with the primary content?
So, on February 24th, Google made possibly the most visible change they've ever made to your search results.
This is a relatively large change to the algorithm. About 12% of queries are affected.
And we found out what sites Google thinks you want to read and what sites Google thinks are content farms. Though Cutts is cagey when it comes to naming names other people have, eHow was spared initially, but Examiner was not, according to one study. The site that pays Maggio $1 an article is almost 80% less visible than it was before Google made the change. And Google continues to tweak its algorithm, implicitly, if not explicitly, targeting content farms. After another update last week, eHow's visibility did drop, though by how much is in dispute. But the story's not over yet. I'm going to bring back Daniel Roth from Fortune magazine to make one last point. He says, what if people just start searching the web without Google? That kind of messes up the game for all the players.
I know, speaking personally, I read a lot from what I see from my friends on Twitter.
Roth says your social network might be the next search engine, and it's still pretty hard to game the system of hearing directly from your friends.
When they suggest a story, I'm way more likely to click on it because it's already been vetted. So I spend less time on aggregation sites, and I spend more time looking to see what my friends are aggregating for me. And how do you win in that game? I think you win in that game by writing stories that people really want to read.
If people stop using Google for search and travel the internet by a new path, like Facebook or Twitter, then the game starts all over again. Zoe Chace, NPR News.